Hello, friends, and welcome to another edition of Crossroads, where faith and culture meet. We have a very special program and a very special guest with us today. Rita Dunaway usually serves as co-host, but she is doubling this morning as our special guest. And why is that? Because she is a constitutional scholar, and we are going to be looking at the state of our Constitution, particularly in the context of our Supreme Court and the vacancy that has been left by the death of Antonin Scalia. So there's been a lot of interest and concern today about the Supreme Court in two areas. One is because of the recent decisions that we'll be talking about, and the second one is who is going to replace Scalia on the court. First of all, I'd just like to suggest, what are the qualifications that the Bible suggests for a good judge? This comes out of Exodus, where Jethro is urging Moses to find some people who will help him judge the people of Israel. And he had four qualifications. They must be able, they must fear God, they must love truth, and they must hate covetousness. Four primary qualifications for a good justice. And I'll add one more. And this is something that Jesus said when he was talking to some of the Jewish leaders, that they must love the praise of God over the praise of men. Do not be swayed by the whims of the culture, but rely on biblical truth to make good judgments.
Wow, that's such a rare quality, Dean, in any kind of public official this day and age. It's hard to find people who are more concerned about what God thinks of them than what the electorate thinks of them.
Well, and Rita, it's not just public officials. It's you and them. I don't
That's
know about
right.
you, but it's me every day.
Yeah, you can count me in too.
Battling that tendency to seek the approval of man over the approval of God. And that really introduces us to our subject in a nation where the Constitution is being turned on its head all the time as a result of judicial activism. Justice Antonin Scalia was a hero to those of us who are committed to the Constitution. Love him or hate him, and there are people on both sides. He was universally respected as one of the boldest and brightest justices in our lifetime, and perhaps in all of America's legal history, going back over 200 years. So his passing earlier this year has now left us with a huge hole on the Supreme Court. So this morning, Rita is going to examine his legacy and how his death and his absence on the court will affect all of us in the days ahead. Now, I always introduce our special guests, so I need to say a word or two about Rita. Rita, cut me off if I go too long here.
You know I will. I may not be your most compliant guest ever.
But Rita has been on the front lines with the Valley Family Forum from the very beginning in 2003 when she helped lead the drive against sexually oriented businesses, SOBs we call them, in Harrisonburg. And then it was Rita who helped lead the drive in 2006 to restore religious freedom to Luis Padilla when he went against Cargill over his religious freedom and right of expression. In recognition of her outstanding leadership, we gave Rita our very first William Wilberforce Award in 2010. But her list of achievements goes on. She helped lead the drive for landmark pro-life bills in the General Assembly. She helped defend religious liberty before various courts, including the Supreme Court. And just by way of background, she does have academic background for doing all this. Let me indicate that she received her summa cum laude from West Virginia University and then her cum laude degree from Washington and Lee University School of Law. Following that, she was working with the Rutherford Institute in Charlottesville, with the Virginia Christian Alliance in Richmond, and is now a leading advocate for the Convention of States initiative across America. She lives in Harrisonburg with her husband, Scott, and two children. There, did I cover it all?
I think you did. I think you got every accomplishment in there. Thank you.
You're welcome. Well, Rita, let's go ahead then. Get us started about Scalia.
Yeah. Well, you know, the first thing I want to say in just setting the groundwork about Scalia, because we're going to focus in the program on some of his major opinions that he wrote and just summarizing his perspective and his interpretation of the Constitution, which of course we believe is the correct way to interpret the Constitution. And that's really what's important about his legacy. But before we get into that, which is sort of, you know, lofty and high end, what I want everyone to know is just something that everyone can appreciate about Justice Scalia is that as brilliant as he was, and he absolutely was just a brilliant Supreme Court justice, he was just such a real person. And if you've ever seen any of the interviews that he's done, I'm sure you have, Dean, he was funny, he was down to earth, he was engaging, and that really comes through in a lot of the opinions that he's written. So I would encourage listeners, you know, maybe your interest will be piqued by some of the discussion today, but go on the internet. You can read any opinion that he's written, and so many of them are actually funny. They are just fun to read.
Scathing,
yes,
but
some
funny.
Of them are, yes, some of them are pretty intense.
And you know, Rita, a remarkable thing is he could be good friends with people who were diametrically opposed to his opinions. I'm talking about Ruth Bader Ginsburg, for example.
Whom he
socially.
Would call his best friend on the Supreme
That's
Court.
That's amazing. That's hard.
It is really remarkable.
Yes.
You know, one of my dearest memories in my, as far as my professional life goes, was hearing Justice Scalia speak in person at my alma mater, Washington and Lee, not long after I became an attorney. I heard that he was going to be there, so I made the trip down to Lexington just to hear him speak.
Was he a Supreme Court justice at that
yes,
time?
Yes, he was.
Okay.
And I haven't been out of school that long, Dean.
Well, I knew I was taking a chance on that.
You are in trouble. We're going to have to talk after the program. But, you know, I remember very distinctly, we'll never forget, Justice Scalia talking about canons of interpretation, how you interpret the Constitution, and he said it very plainly. He said, "The Constitution I interpret is not a living, breathing document. It is dead." And of course, he was, you know, using humor to make his point there. But the point was that he does not believe in this idea of the living, breathing Constitution whose meaning changes over time. And, you know, the interpretation of something next year may very well be different than what it is this year. The idea that the words of the Constitution have a definite meaning that we know based on history is a fundamental tenet of conservatism. And Scalia always honored that concept of originalism. And I want to emphasize that it's not, and Scalia would say this, it's not about original intent. We're not supposed to try to figure out what was going on in the minds or hearts of the drafters of the Constitution. It was about original meaning. What did the words mean at the time they were written? And few other justices have been as faithful to that idea as Justice Scalia.
Well, and I want to make a comment too, Rita. You use the word conservatism, which has been sort of politically abused by our current culture. Yes. Conservatism, in its real meaning, is to conserve truth. Never deviate from truth. Conserve truth in our culture and in our lives, the truth of the Constitution, and that relates to biblical truth as well. Conserve the truth. And that really, I think, brings us back, making the connection between the idea of a definite meaning of words in the Constitution and the concept of absolute truth. It's the same way with the Constitution as it is with the Bible. Relativism in the interpretation of both documents leads us down a path of moral relativism and cultural degradation. Beware. Well, Rita, before we talk, though, about Scalia and some of his opinions, Why is the Constitution so important to the rule of law in America? And what are some of its core principles that you find so key to our understanding? Why is the Constitution so important to us? It's a supreme law of the land, isn't it?
It is. The Constitution, you know, I'm sort of puzzled just hearing you ask the question, but it's a good question to ask because a lot of people, unfortunately, don't think about it.
They've never read it.
Yeah, the Constitution is what sets up the whole framework of our federal system of government. It is the guidebook. It is the operating manual. And one of the most important features of it is that it sets forth the limited powers vested in the federal government, which unfortunately have been just abused and stretched completely out of context.
And I would suggest, too, the separation of powers, because power concentrated in the hands of the few is always going to be abused. And there was that beautiful balance, the separation of powers. Well, let's talk then about some of the noteworthy opinions by Scalia in cases involving issues that we find today at the crossroads where faith and culture meet.
Sure. Well, I want to start with one of the most recent, really landmark decisions of the Supreme Court. And before I actually talk about the opinion, I want to point out that some of Justice Scalia's most important opinions are found in his dissents. It's not always in the majority opinion. And I think it's important for listeners to understand that when the Supreme Court issues a decision, there's a majority opinion, which reflects the ruling of the court and sort of explains it. And then there will often be dissenting opinions by the justices who believe the court got it wrong and would have decided it the other way. And a lot of times, those dissenting opinions over time can become adopted and later end up being the rule that is adopted in a later case. And they can be profoundly impactful on influencing the thinking and reasoning of society. And even the dissenting opinions can and will be used by attorneys in lower courts as they argue that the law should be applied in a different way or that the interpretation should be changed.
Rita, I just want to draw a lesson from that for all of us. Just because the majority feels one way doesn't mean that we should just roll over and accept it if we believe it is wrong. We have to stand up for what is right, regardless of what the culture is saying.
Absolutely right. So let's start with Scalia's dissent in the recent decision Obergefell versus Hodges dealing with same-sex marriage, where the majority of the court basically mandated that all 50 states must recognize same-sex marriage, even those states that had constitutional provisions in their state constitutions recognizing marriage as between one man and one woman. And I think an important lesson from Scalia's dissent in this case is that one of the things Scalia did so well is to start from the fundamental primary question, which is, should the court be involved in deciding this issue at all, or should it instead be left to the states? So in this particular case, Scalia delivered a classic, just scathing dissent addressing the judicial activism that produced the court's opinion. And I'm going to tell you in his own words, because I can't say it any better than Justice Scalia. He said, and I quote, "Today's decree says that my ruler and the ruler of 320 million Americans coast to coast is a majority of the 9 lawyers on the Supreme Court. The opinion in these cases is the furthest extension in fact and the furthest extension one can even imagine of the court's claimed power to create liberties that the Constitution and its amendments neglect to mention. This practice of constitutional revision by an unelected committee of 9, always accompanied, as it is today, by extravagant praise of liberty, robs the people of the most important liberty they asserted in the Declaration of Independence and won in the Revolution of 1776, the freedom to govern themselves, end quote. So what Justice Scalia did was to point out that the court was wrongfully interfering in the ability of every American to be a self-governing people.
And this case, of course, particularly addressed the issue of same-sex marriage. I'd like to note for our listeners that this is one of the most recent decisions on which he spoke, and that was issued on June 26th of last year, a recent decision. Remember that date because it's going to come up again. You mentioned the right to govern ourselves as expressed in the Declaration of Independence, but also codified by the 10th Amendment to the Constitution. And I'm going to read that. Yeah. The powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states, respectively, or to the people. If the federal government isn't specifically authorized to exercise this power, then they have no right to exercise the power. It belongs to the states and to the people. So that reminds you of something else you heard, I think, that Scalia said.
Yeah, so on this idea of the court basically creating new constitutional rights that aren't actually in the Constitution, one of the things Justice Scalia said when I heard him speak was, you know, there are all kinds of rights that might be nice, that people would like to have. Most people might think they'd be a good thing, but not every right that someone might like to have was enshrined in the Constitution. And Scalia would say it is wrong for the court to just decide that they're going to use a creative interpretation to add rights into the Constitution. We have a process for amending the Constitution. It's in Article 5, but this is not the way it is to be done.
And Rita, Scalia foresaw that way back in 2003, where there was a decision that you'll be talking about, Lawrence v. Texas. By the way, that too happened on June 26th, the same date as Obergefell, where he predicted that the court would ultimately be forced to open the door to same-sex unions when the court struck down a Texas statute which prohibited homosexual acts. What he predicted then certainly came true just within the past year.
Absolutely right. And what should be scary to us is that in that opinion that he wrote in Lawrence v. Texas, which again was his dissenting opinion, he predicted that the court's decision there would lead not only to same-sex marriage, but also the logic of it would force the court to allow bigamy, adult incest, prostitution, adultery, fornication, and obscenity. The logic of the court's decision, if it's intellectually honest, would lead the court to be forced to uphold all of those, or force the states to allow them and strike down the laws that currently would prohibit them. And Scalia said, and again I quote, "Today's opinion," this is the Lawrence v. Texas decision, "is the product of a court, which is the product of a law profession culture that has largely signed on to the so-called homosexual agenda, by which I mean the agenda promoted by some homosexual activists directed at eliminating the moral opprobrium that has traditionally attached to homosexual conduct," end quote. And to summarize, Scalia said, "This effectively decrees the end of all morals legislation."
Well, Rita, and in addition to that list that he mentioned, you could add polygamy as well.
Absolutely.
The door has now been opened to multiple marriages. So that really, too, addresses the whole idea that you can't legislate morality. Well, that is precisely what the Supreme Court has done, and that is precisely what our legislatures are supposed to do, to make a clear distinction between what is right and what is wrong, even a stop sign. That's running through it is wrong. You got to stop there. That's right.
Yep.
That's a moral decision.
Absolutely.
That you have to make. Now, that is one of the principal rules of law, to legislate between right and wrong. Well, what's next on your opinion list?
I would say number three for me, as far as, you know, important Scalia-authored opinions, is his dissent in Planned Parenthood versus Casey.
Well, that was a decision, as I recall, Rita, where the Supreme Court affirmed the decision in Roe v. Wade, which is back in 1973, and it said that states cannot impose an undue burden on a woman's right to abort her unborn child. So I'm interested, where does the Constitution provide that right, and what was the gist of Scalia's dissent?
Well, where indeed does the Constitution provide that right?
Yeah.
So once again, what Justice Scalia did was to point out frankly and honestly that the Constitution simply does not create a right to abortion. That is an area that is left to the states to govern. So here's my favorite quote from that opinion. He said, "The issue in this case is not whether the power of a woman to abort her unborn child is a liberty in the absolute sense, or even whether it is a liberty of great importance to many women. Of course, it is both. The issue is whether it is a liberty protected by the Constitution of the United States. I am sure it is not. I reached that conclusion not because of anything so exalted as my views concerning the concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe, and of the mystery of human life. Rather, I reach it for the same reason I reached the conclusion that bigamy is not constitutionally protected, because of two simple facts. Number one, the Constitution says absolutely nothing about it. And number two, the longstanding traditions of American society have permitted it to be legally prescribed."
Rita, I just have to sit here and laugh at the obtuseness of these brilliant people sitting on the bench of our Supreme Court. And I am sure they are discovering in our Constitution today the right of men to go into women's restrooms. I can't believe it. Okay. Well, who can argue with that? What's next?
Well, you know, I want to point out that what Scalia always did so well was to call the court out on the holes in its reasoning and to point out when the court had gone away from interpreting the words of the Constitution and into the realm of recreating the Constitution according to its own preferences, pointing out that the court has basically revised the Constitution and in a completely illegitimate way.
Well, Rita, we've talked about two great issues, marriage and life. I wonder, right now, religious liberty is a huge issue. I know he was a huge champion of a liberty that is actually protected by the Constitution. We referred to it. But in this case, it's also referred to in the First Amendment of the Constitution, which, again, I have right before me, and we need to read the text directly. The First Amendment to the Constitution says, "Congress shall make no law prohibiting the free exercise of religion." So, tell us about his particularly noteworthy opinions in a religious liberty case.
Well, you know, a good representative of his decisions in this whole area is Scalia's dissent in McCreary County versus ACLU. This is the case where the court struck down the display of the Ten Commandments inside a courthouse. Do you remember that? It was
some years back. Well, they've been all over the lot on the Ten Commandments.
Absolutely, yes. On the same day, they upheld one display and struck down the other one. So this is the case where they struck down the display.
Scalia, they can have a display in their own Supreme Court building.
Yeah, right. It's hard even for attorneys to make sense of what the rules are in this issue. Scalia first pointed out that the same week that Congress submitted the Establishment Clause as part of the Bill of Rights for ratification by the states, it enacted legislation providing for paid chaplains to the House and Senate. There was no inconsistency there. He reminded the court that the founders believed morality was essential to the well-being of society and that encouragement of religion was the best way to foster morality.
George Washington made that very clear in his farewell address. Religion and morality are the cornerstones, the principal pillars of American prosperity.
It is completely clear. So Scalia said, and here's a quote, with all of this reality and much more staring it in the face, how can the court possibly assert that the First Amendment mandates government neutrality between religion and non-religion? Today's opinion forthrightly, or actually somewhat less than forthrightly, admits that it does not rest upon consistently applied principle, end quote. And you know, that absolutely sums up the court's disastrous jurisprudence on the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment, which people say sets up the separation of church and state. There's simply no escaping the fact that the Establishment Clause forbids the establishment of a national church or an official religion, period. Yeah. It was never meant to forbid any act on the part of government that exemplifies our historical ties to Christianity. So when the court continues to interpret it that way, it just ends up in a mess.
Well, if you're just tuning in, our guest and our co-host is Rita Dunaway and our constitutional expert. Rita, I think we have time for one more opinion.
Yeah, the other opinion I think we have to mention in this context of talking about religious liberty and the Establishment Clause is the 1992 case of Lee versus Wiseman, where the majority of the court held that a school had violated the Establishment Clause by allowing a rabbi to deliver an invocation at a high school graduation ceremony. Scalia authored the dissenting opinion in that case, and his introduction is a good summary of the opinion. I'm going to quote again because, once again, I can't say it any better than he can.
Yep.
He said, "In holding that the Establishment Clause prohibits invocations and benedictions at public school graduation ceremonies, the court, with nary a mention that it is doing so, lays waste a tradition that is as old as public school graduation ceremonies themselves. And that is a component of an even more longstanding American tradition of non-sectarian prayer to God at public celebrations generally. Today's opinion shows more forcefully than volumes of argumentation why our nation's protection, that fortress which is our Constitution, cannot possibly rest upon the changeable philosophical predilections of the justices of this court, but must have deep foundations in the historic practices of our people." End quote. So once again, Dean, Justice Scalia pointed out the hypocrisy in the court's modern interpretation of the Establishment Clause when viewed in light of our history, which is the proper way to understand constitutional language. It really brings us full circle.
Boy, it does. But Rita, just wrap it up now. Five great opinions. Three tremendously important issues, marriage life, religious liberty. Put it all together. How would you sum up his take on the role of the court in society today?
I want to sum it up with another Justice Scalia quote. You know, this is a really sad quote. But in one case, which the case itself isn't even very important, no one would recognize the name of it, Justice Scalia lamented, "The court must be living in another world," he said. "Day by day, case by case, it is busy designing a constitution for a country I do not recognize." End quote. Dean, we need to get Supreme Court justices who interpret the Constitution according to its original meaning. That's the only way it can be properly interpreted.
It sounds like Alice in Wonderland, where we can make words mean whatever we want them to mean. That wraps it up, Rita. Thank you so much for pulling this all together. And just to underscore, there are three Supreme Court justices who are over 70 years old. One is over 80 years old, Ruth Bader Ginsburg. The next president will appoint perhaps two, maybe three, maybe even four Supreme Court justices. It is critically important to have somebody like Scalia on the bench. Thank you all for listening. I want to close by thanking two of our great sponsors, Blue Ridge Chimney Services and Dunaway Dentistry, also known as Valley Smile Care. Check them out and let them help you with your chimney and your teeth. I'm Dean Welty, along with our co-host and guest, Rita Dunaway, inviting you to join us again next week at the Crossroads, where faith and culture meet. And until then, have a great week putting your faith into action.